This is Mae Brussel. This is the second half of broadcast number 686 on KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. It's January the 28th, 1985. And now I'll continue with the story of Mr. Mengele. I have a friend who wrote a book about Joseph Mengele, Brian Richard Boland. I've mentioned him before. The book is called The Final Trace, published in 1983. All the work that he did with another associate in South America, they were employed to bring Mr. Mengele back, if they could, bring him back alive to this country, wasn't possible because he was very much more protected than Klaus Barbie. They could have brought him back dead, but they wanted to bring him back alive. And in the course of their work, they have a lot of information and have studied various problems of Nazis who escaped and so forth. But his life was threatened, and he was in danger if this book was published as nonfiction. And the only part of fiction that he put in it, according to what he says, is the epilogue. And it was because of the epilogue and certain events in the news this week that I thought I'd better call him and update the news. Now, this is the fellow who had hired airplanes to take him down to South America. He's been down there many times. And on one of the trips that he was supposed to go, the plane was stopped. I mean, he couldn't use that pilot. It was Mr. William Hetrick, because Hetrick had been arrested and was involved later then with bringing in John DeLorean. And it was Hetrick's trips down to Klaus Barbie that caused Richard to understand or Boland the connection of the Klaus Barbie, John DeLorean narcotic connections. And furthermore, he was the one who told me about the one of the vice presidents of Associated Press who took the money from the narcotic traffic that Mr. Martin Bormann receives, not Martin Bormann, but Klaus Barbie, and also they work with Martin Bormann as the banker. The money from the drug profits goes into an account in Switzerland, represented by the attorney of Joseph Mengele. So the Mengele story ties into the United States Hollywood connection of narcotics in New York and New Jersey and London and Ireland and the Swiss Bank and the Cayman Banks of Mr. DeLorean and all that. But it ties to Klaus Barbie and Joseph Mengele in a very direct way. And Mengele's name is in the news this past week because of certain documents that were received from the Freedom of Information Act. But and they've also admitted that they've locked up five. It's closer probably to 500. But they haven't retrieved a lot of material that is pertinent to this story. But the last part of the epilogue of Richard's book on Mengele is about a man whose daughter is held as a hostage to Mengele, that they're supposed to bring in Mr. Walter Rauch, three top Nazis, and Mueller and Mengele's into an airport in Mexico, or to they're going to be turned in or agree to come in. And when they come, they already have another plane ready, and they understand that they're going to be trapped, and they hire a private plane to take off for La Paz, Bolivia. And the epilogue is about what happens to the plane from the time that the three top Nazis leave South America and then quickly return back to South America when they understand that they're about to be captured. The epilogue says someone learned about the bomb that Hermann Fried had stored on the aeroplane that was taking them down there, and they were able to get a message through to the distinguished passengers, but not soon enough. 4 hours after Rosen's death, Rosen was a fellow shot at the airport when the plane took off, who was wanting to bring them in, the air traffic controller at El Alto Aeropuerto on the plane above La Paz, Bolivia, announced there would be an emergency landing and cleared the airport approach for all traffic. However, the charter passenger jet exploded violently in midair about a mile from touchdown, shrinking wreckage over the surrounding countryside. During the following days, rescue parties were able to retrieve the bodies of all but three persons known to have been aboard the plane. A week later, an Associated Press stringer, he brings in his AP man, filed a short item about reports from peasants in northern Bolivia who saw what they officials believed were three parachutes in the sky shortly before the plane exploded. The police are investigating. So that was the last chapter of his book, which is based on all true experience of Joseph Mengele in South America. And the reason I called him was because of the airplane crash that took place in the Andes just at a very important time. And I took note of it because Mrs. B. Clarsfield, the woman who has claimed the responsibility, and probably so, of bringing Claus Barbie to Europe, if not to trial yet, it hasn't started. She's made trips to South America, one to Argentina, to help the families of the victims of death squads, about 50,000 that were killed, and the mothers protesting there and in Chile against Pinochet. And she recently, at the end of the year, I remember the date because I was down in Los Angeles. It was on the 31st of December, just this last month, or around January the 1st. Bea Clarsfield was on her way down to Bolivia to ask Mr. Stroessner to give Claus Barbie back for trial, which, of course, he never would do. And just about the same day she was arriving down there on this trip, there was an interesting airplane crash on the way to La Paz, Bolivia. This one is from Paraguay, Asuncion to La Paz, Bolivia. The Los Angeles Times, January 3rd, has the story, U.S. envoy's wife among 29 lost in the Andes crash. La Paz, Bolivia, the wreckage of an Eastern Airline jetliner was found Wednesday night on the side of the Illimani Mountain 20 hours after it was reported missing. There were no survivors, apparently, among the 29 passengers and crew. 8 Americans, among them the wife of the American ambassador, Mary Ann Davis, wife of the United States ambassador to Paraguay, and his name is Arthur H. Davis, and the United States State Department's representative for the Peace Corps, William Kelly, the director of the Peace Corps in Paraguay. Now, according to the news, they sighted a wreckage of the plane. There are no visible markings on the airplane. We can't tell if it's an Eastern airline or not because there's no Eastern colors or no Eastern logo. Now, the head of Eastern Airline is Mr. Borman, the former NASA pilot who worked with Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger. And this plane, if it's a commercial plane taking the wife of the ambassador, the Peace Corps director, would certainly have markings on it. This reminds me of the kind of plane that would fly from Nicaragua to try and attempt the Bay of Pigs invasion for the CIA. They have a plane that leaves Asuncion in Paraguay, and this plane had no markings, and it had no logo, and no Eastern colors to identify it, which is really weird. The Bolivian Air Force plane, the Bolivian Army sent somebody in there, Colonel Grover Rojas said, and they said it appeared the plane crashed head-on. Among the plane passengers were 9 Korean passengers and 7 Paraguayan. Now, Reverend Moon and the South Koreans were very active and are in nearby Uruguay. Reverend Moon is supposed to practically own that entire country, and he's been very close to providing help for Licio Gelli and also for Mr. Joseph Mengele. There were stories about Mengele and the Moonies being given protection down in South America. There were Koreans on the plane, the head of the Peace Corps, and the ambassador's wife. It left Asuncion, Paraguay at 5:57 p.m., and it was due 2 hours later at 7:48, and it wasn't seen. Another story, January the 6th in the San Jose Mercury, tells about the Peruvian Army helicopter arriving to try and retrieve parts of the plane. I think of Peru and Mr. Stefano Jeff Delachaye, the right-hand man of the death squads of Europe, and Licio Gelli, working with the Shining Path and the narcotic people in Peru. The Bolivian Army sent people up to the plane. The Peruvians sent a helicopter up to retrieve, and the United States Air Force was going to send a high-altitude helicopter. The team went up there, and they reached the plane. The plane was destroyed, but there were no survivors. Now, the first thing that came to my mind was this so-called fiction based upon a lot of logical deductions that when I figured that maybe with the day that Mrs. Clarsfield arrived, that some of the Moonies and the Peace Corps director and the ambassador's wife would be on there on this airplane, this unmarked, incidentally, I've mentioned, airplane, and be taking this thing to get him out of Paraguay and into Bolivia, where Joseph Mengele's could be protected. Maybe Christian Von Damme, the vice president of the Bank of America from La Paz, Bolivia, might meet him. That's Helene Von Damme's husband. She's our ambassador to Vienna, and she keeps his name. And I haven't any doubt that Christian Von Damme knows Claus Barbie and Joseph Mengele very well down there. If if they had all worked with the American government, if they did, and he's from Germany and works down there in that position at the Bank of America, I haven't any doubt that Christian von Daum would know a lot about this if he were brought home and asked some questions. But the point is that once the plane was found, they're looking, always looking for that little black box like the Korean Airline 007. But they spent time around it. There isn't the sign of a passenger. And I thought that was an interesting thing to read about the search for Joseph Mengele now and sending for department papers, State Department papers on him, and the way that mysterious plane left, because it's really been a non-story. Eastern Airlines has said very little about that plane, and there hasn't been too much notice or comments about the plane wreck. And there's been a lot of news about Mr. Mengele. Now, the Army withholding these papers is important. I have had on the air many, many times. A lot of new listeners don't know it. Papers from the FBI, Freedom of Information, saying that Joseph Mengele lived up near near Sedona, Arizona, and he was in Nevada and California, and he used an alias, Mr. Erdemann, and if you want, I can read it again on the air for you. I have it here. The reason I got that from Freedom of Information Act was that the person who got it for me was with Joseph Mengele in Honduras. And he was with his own uncle, who was a Nazi war criminal during the war, who fled this country. Now, the Wiesenthal Center and Rabbi Heir, H-E-I-R, and Simon Wiesenthal and Mr. Mendelssohn in Washington, the Jewish organizations will not admit or even attempt to explain. Their answer is that there was another Joseph Mengele's, and that wasn't him. The reason this Mengele's was never brought to trial was he was an American citizen. He was naturalized in New York. His naturalization was suspect, just like Dr. Urban, who worked with the Gestapo and worked with Errol Flynn. This is a story, again, like the Howard Hughes story, that just simply won't wash away because people refuse to go into where is the other Mengele. If this is a different Joseph Mengele, just show me the other one and I'll be satisfied. Well, one more item, and we get to Howard Hughes. I just have 15 more minutes, so we'll have to do a lot of views next week. The people that were shot by John Hinckley have asked a lawsuit that recently was turned down, the victims, to pursue the case against the doctor in Denver, Colorado, the psychiatrist, who didn't tell him that John W. Hinckley was dangerous. These men have sued the psychiatrist, John J. Hopper, Jr., because they didn't warn the Secret Service about him, and they claim that their damages are severe. One is Press Secretary James Brady. The other is Secret Service agent Timothy J. McCarthy, and the other is Thomas K. Delahanty. Now, I called Washington, D.C., and Maryland, and Georgetown, and Virginia, and all I could find out is that these three names are unlisted, and I would like to get in touch with them for the reason that John Hinckley was in the Posse Comitatus. He was in the American Nazi Party. And I think we could prove his links up to the Aryan Nation and Mr. Gale and the California Nazis and the extreme right-wing group that he traveled with and worked with. And if all of this is true, then the prosecution and Edward Bennett Williams and the entire legal team denied these people of their rights, not only of the security of knowing about John Hinckley and his interest in the Kennedy assassination and in conspiracies and in murders, but his links in California and to Chicago and in Tennessee and Texas to the Nazi Party and the Posse Comitatus. Now, I do have the names of the Secret Service men who were at my home. They came once because I believe that was John Hinckley in front of my house in January of 1981. They came back when they identified the car of Hinckley, the license that I wrote down, as being a member of the Posse Comitatus. Now, that's part of the identity group and the Christian fundamentalist group that do want to kill every Jew in America, every black in America, that have computers from Texas that are set up in Idaho and around the country to give names and addresses of where people live. The very month that I believe that was Hinckley at my house in January, there's an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about the Nazis and their role in killing John Kennedy and John Lennon and a lot of other people in between. And it was no coincidence, within a short time, this particular person was sitting in front of my house. So if any of you can help me get the address of one of those three men, or all of them, I would appreciate it, and I'll get to them and see what we can do. Now, we'll start on the use, and I'll do a lot more next week. I did want to update some of these things, like Mengele's and Donovan, and some important things that are in the news. There's a new book out about Howard Hughes. It's getting a lot of attention. Citizen Hughes by Michael Drosnin, Drosnin. I'll have the book by tomorrow. Tom Davis carries it at Research, and he's bringing it down, and I will have the book. I heard the Phil Donahue show of the author, Michael Drosnin, sitting there with Mr. Mayhew. I taped it. Many of you saw it, and I'll send for that. It was a pathetic sparring between two people who are both guilty. Mayhew claiming that Drosnin is writing a book about stolen material, that he should be locked up for stealing, having people steal it from the Hughes headquarters on Romaine Street in Hollywood and making money off of it. And Mayhew should be locked up for making money off of Hughes when he never saw him, and hiring assassination hit teams and justifying himself on the television that if somebody had shot Hitler, he would have saved the world. Well, Fidel Castro isn't exactly Adolf Hitler, and using Sam Giancana and John Rosselli with their track records, Robert Mayhew can't interpret for us who's to live and who's to die according to his particular politics. There's another book, The Secret Agenda by Jim Hogan, on Watergate and Howard Hughes. And I've studied so much about Hughes that I will get into both of those books at great length and in detail. There is a series running out, five-part series, in various newspapers syndicated on the book on Howard Hughes. And from Houston, Texas, a friend sent me part five of that, where it refers to the book that Clifford Irving did on Howard Hughes. He wrote a book and pretended that they were memos of Howard Hughes because he decided that Hughes was either dead or disabled and no shape to make a public appearance. So that gave him an idea that he would concoct his own epic and present it to the world as an autobiography. Now, the important thing about these articles, and this is why you have to take time to read them and don't listen to all the talk shows or the blah blahs about it, and they're important only to see how much gets passed up as disinformation to add to further lies. Clifford Irving may have had the idea that he wanted to write a book about Hughes because he was dead or disabled. Well, there's a difference. If you're dead, then somebody is running the empire, so you have to confront the empire. If they're simulating his life, you're in more trouble than if he's alive, because if he's dead and the empire is still running, what makes you think at that point you can pretend you know Hughes? They'd come down harder than ever. And if he's disabled, the same logic applies. Clifford Irving says, I think I'll write a book about Howard Hughes. This was in 1971, 72. Because if he's incapacitated, he won't know the difference. Therefore, I can do it. The important thing is that McGraw-Hill, the publisher, accepted the book knowing that Howard Hughes was either alive or controlled by a mass block that would respond. And the second point is that they brought in the world's best handwriting experts, as they did with the Hitler diaries, where that 3 million went to the Waffen-SS. Forget the hoax. The money went to the rebirth of the Nazi Party. That's where it sits. And they brought in Mr. Osborne and a team of the world's greatest handwriting experts. And the handwriting expert said, yes, that is Howard Hughes. So how would Clifford Irving get past the best experts unless the book was meant to be put out? And the book was meant to be out because then it created the excuse for a telephone conversation that was taped, and I've played the record on the air, and I'll play it again, of Howard supposedly talking. The Clifford Irving story is a very important part of Watergate and of the Hughes saga, and later I'll get back to it again and put it in its context. Now, how and when did I get started in the Hughes case? I was doing my research on the Kennedy assassination, and then when my article came out in The Realist, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped?, Bruce Roberts called me. I was on KGO radio and contacted me, and he's the fellow who wrote the Gemstone File. and he gave me 300 or 400 handwritten pages about the gemstone that was the Watergate secrets and the Washington secrets, and there were two important areas that he opened up for me that I was not studying at the time, when I had been studying the Kennedy assassination from November 63 until I started the Watergate story in June of 72. One was the Vatican connection to the spy network around the world that I hadn't even really thought about. I'd been cross-filing the Warren Commission hearings, and you know there wasn't much about the Vatican in there. He opened up the Vatican connection. Well, in this past year, there were books, O Vatican by Paul Hoffman, In God's Name by David Yalop, St. Peter's Banker by DeFonso, God's Banker by Cornwell, La Popessa, The Vatican Connections by Richard Hammer, The Vatican Millions by Avril Manhattan. Just seven books is 10 or more good exposés of the Vatican. In those days, Vatican was not a household word. Vatican and OSS, Vatican and Nazis. There wasn't that much about the Vatican. He opened that up for me. And the second part he opened up for me is the Howard Hughes connections. He told me that Hughes was buried in 1971, that he was staying with Onassis, who was taking care of him because he was brain damaged. And at that point, I got as many articles and books and collected filing cabinets of Hughes, every book that was written. And I wrote an article for Playgirl magazine with Stephanie Caruana, Is Howard Hughes Dead and Buried Off a Greek Island? And I'll tell you more about that article if we have time now, otherwise next week. You can send for that if you want. I charge $3. And I'll send you a copy. It was published in December 1974, 11 years ago. Is Howard Hughes Dead and Buried Off a Greek Island? And that was based on 2 years' research. I took what Bruce Roberts told me and then spent those 2 years delving into it and was convinced that Howard was in fact dead and that he didn't exist any longer from April 16th, 1971 on. And, of course, that kept me saving every article and every book from 71. The Watergate broke in 72, and the Hughes name came forward. He wasn't a household word, believe me, until 72 and 73 with the Watergate hearings. So I was saving this material on Hughes. And then in 1976, the body was cashed in, brought from Mexico to Texas. And then, of course, I had to follow even more, and to this day, the evidence of why it isn't Howard Hughes and why they're all lying and what happened to Howard Hughes. Now, I did this work until the person died that they called Howard Hughes. I immediately contacted Clarence Kelly of the FBI, the director at the time of the fingerprinting of Hughes. I corresponded with him, and many of you know I was making a movie with Manuel Zecina on the Howard Hughes story. He's a producer from Nicaragua who was kicked out of this country because of what we were doing on the Hughes story, and my house was broken into, and my papers and correspondence with Clarence Kelly were removed, and the FBI sent them back to me without his original signature on, just our correspondence. And through Zecina, I met Terry Moore, and through Terry Moore, I met Johnny Meyer, and I'll do more on Johnny next week, who worked for the Hughes organization, who confirmed that Hughes had been dead, that I was absolutely right, that there was no Howard Hughes. Now, there were a lot of reasons that they had to bring him in, I use the word cash him in, by April the 5th, 1976. As a matter of fact, I had a sweatshirt made. I have a few of these sweatshirts. They're made in Colorado that have sayings on that I like. This one was made immediately. Exhume Vance Cooper, 4-5-April the 5th, 1976, Houston, Texas. That's when the body was placed into the grave. December the 15th, 1976, on Good Morning America, and this has all been taped. In fact, I was going to put it on the tape tonight, but I was too lazy to get out of my boxes of stuff, so I'll dig for it next week and put it on the air for you. It's an interview with Brooks Randall on Good Morning America, December the 15th, 1976. Jack Anderson was on, and David Hartman, and Brooks Randall was interesting to me because I wrote in the article 2 years earlier that he was one of the doubles for Howard Hughes, and he confirmed on this program that he was the body of Howard Hughes for various activities, but he was not the voice. He said the voice of Howard Hughes was Vance Cooper, who's buried in a Texas grave. The man in the grave buried April the 5th, 1979, is not Howard Hughes. Now, this is old news. This is what Frank Sinatra would call old news, or what CBS would call boring. You know, we don't want that old stuff. Well, too bad. Dig it out, David Hartman, and put it on. Vance Cooper was in the grave, and he went on to say that Mike Shunard hired the bodyguards and the doubles for Howard Hughes, and the office staff that were working for Hughes, he said on the television, never saw any of them in their life, which was true, and that all the stories had to be straightened out through one certain source, and that the Attorney General, John Hill, didn't believe that Howard Hughes was buried in Houston, Texas. This was all on Good Morning America. Now, I tried to get the Hughes estate money divided between both California and Texas because of the property owned by Hughes in both states, and was instrumental early in the case of investigating where the taxes should go. The controller of the state, Ken Corey, came to my house with several people, and I suggested they exhume the body and decide, because he was drugged and kidnapped in California at the Beverly Hills Hotel and kept as a prisoner and then removed and had brain surgery in Boston. So the choice of residence had nothing to do with Las Vegas, because nobody in Nevada could prove that he ever lived there. And it turned out that hundreds of millions of dollars went to California and to Texas and not to Nevada. For whatever reason they decided, I could prove beyond any doubt, for whatever it is worth, that Hughes was not there and that that all was a fraud. So they, the Attorney General at the time in Texas didn't believe that Howard Hughes was buried there. Jack Anderson said, I went directly to Texas and Clarence Kelly assured me he processed the fingerprints himself. Well, Clarence Kelly is a liar. As a matter of fact, I have an article on the coroner. It's in my files. I have to find it for you. Of the coroner who came from Poland, who works at Houston, Texas. But I've done programs on the coroner in Washington, D.C., the team of them that have been fired or left because they were making the coroner's office political and lying about different autopsies. That was in the Washington Post, July 23, 1984, broadcast 661. A former D.C. medical examiner complains of political meddling in the doctor's postmortem. Well, if you take anybody as important, as powerful as Hughes, there would also be meddling, or could be. Now, just quickly, there were reasons why he had to be turned in as of April, and they were very urgent. And I'll run them through real fast and just give them to you and to conclude, and then I'll continue with Hughes next week. Number one, Donald Nixon was testifying at the Watergate hearings, and John Meyer, M-E-I-E-R, that John Meyer, that after 1972 in June, the Watergate exposures would reveal that 20 Hughes employees that were working with Hughes were working with John Meyer and Donald Nixon, the president's brother. The second point was the Senate Watergate hearings from 1973 to 74, where Hughes attorney Chester Davis was working with Leon Jaworski. You know his history and PAC's work of covering up the Kennedy assassination and so forth. Warren Commission. They wanted to cool the grand jury inquiry into Robert Bennett's office, which was the Hughes public relations man at Mullen Associates in Washington, D.C., the Bennett office, where Watergate defendants met and made plans, and Mullen was a cover for the CIA. Mullen also represented the Free Cuba Committee and sent money to Riley Coffee Company to pay for Lee Harvey Oswald. The next point is that Robert Wright Patman, if Congress was investigating the Hughes Medical Center, the Institute was supposed to give a percentage of their profits in order to be a tax deduction. Their profits were $76.9 million in 1976, and you spent $5 million on research. Another point, Congressman Rosenthal of New York suggested on the floor of Congress that Howard Hughes be declared legally dead because nobody had seen him. The next point is that the Internal Revenue wanted to see him personally about tax deductions from the Institute and look into the power of attorney and the past records up to 1972, who would take over the Institute after Howard. Jack Anderson sent out a trial balloon, writing an article at that time that Howard Hughes could be dead and that he had doubles and that people were forging his name. The Air West lawsuit was taking place, and the stockholders demanded to see Howard Hughes and have an investigation of buying it, dropping the price low so that it could be bought cheap and then raising it up afterwards, and they lost money. And also in March, the House Rules Committee in 1976, they were getting ready to investigate the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and Congressman Madden, M-A-D-D-E-N, said, I think we should include the investigation of Howard Hughes. I read where he disappeared and it's mysterious. So the Congress that was going to have the mandate to investigate the murder of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King got the request from Mr. Madden on the Rules Committee that they should also go into Howard Hughes. And by 1974, this is 2 years later, they're doing this work. Well, the House Rules Assassination Committee was in 1975. But in 74, I was lecturing around the country that Hughes was dead, that he had been dead. In 71, I did television shows with Mort Saul and other people when the Playgirl article came out, and was on KGO and ABC Radio and in New York lecturing that Howard Hughes was dead. And this was in conjunction with the Playgirl article. Well, the tape is up now. I had to rush that through. I'm going to get back to the Hughes with you later. It's terribly important, but we don't have any more time now, so I've got to call it quits. This is Mae Brussel. It's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.